Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
Good Bad Billionaire from the BBC World Service.
The podcast exploring the minds, the motives and the money of some of the world's richest individuals.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Roger Hearing, and on this edition, the search for reliable and affordable vaccines to counter the spread of Mpox after the WHO declares a global health emergency. Also, Japan sees an unexpected growth in its economy. What is the earning potential of England football star Jude Bellingham? And Western tourists to be allowed back into North Korea after 5 years? So how many will come? What will they be allowed to see?
Most of the people who travel to North Korea, they say it's one of the best trips of their lives. But those who don't accept the restrictions, they just don't travel there.
That's all coming up on the programme. But first, the World Health Organization has declared the Mpox outbreak in parts of Africa a public health emergency of international concern. The disease, formerly known as monkeypox, has spread rapidly since the beginning of the year. The WHO head is Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus.
The emergency committee met and advised me that, in its view, the situation constitutes a public health emergency of international concern. I have accepted that advice. In addition to other outbreaks of other clades of Mpox in other parts of Africa, it's clear that a coordinated international response is essential to stop these outbreaks and save lives.
Scientists are concerned about how fast a new variant of the disease is spreading and its high fatality rate. Of course, all this sets off concerns about a new pandemic, although health officials are quick to stress there is no prospect of that at the moment. And as with COVID, there is a need to find effective and affordable vaccines. Dr. Abdou Salam Gueye is the Regional Emergency Director for the World Health Organization. I asked him if any international travel restrictions were likely to prevent further transmission.
Absolutely not. The public health emergency of international concern has been declared because there is Mpox that has appeared in the northern DR Congo and spread to several African countries. And we want to work with our member state and all the international community to stop it as soon as possible. And we absolutely do not need to do some restriction of any kind to the population or the goods circulation in the world because of that. And when this thing becomes also some solution, we will not hesitate to inform you. For the time being, it is not necessary.
But you can envisage a situation. I mean, it is spread by contact, as we know. In order to prevent contact, then there might have to be restrictions in the future.
In the future, we don't know how the situation will be. But from what we know now, the situation does not require restriction of circulation. Actually, as we are speaking, in Africa, there are only two countries that we have reason to believe that there is community transmission. It is DR Congo and Burundi. For the other countries like Rwanda, like Uganda, Kenya, that has also reported clade 1B Mpox, it is some isolated cases or a little cluster that do not really have any implication of global restriction to the country. Actually, the solution is to do a good surveillance to detect the case as early as possible, to make sure that the cases that are detected are treated to avoid the mortality and suffering, but also to make sure that those cases will not transmit the disease to other people. It is particularly about their family, their very close relationship where it can be transmitted.
Okay, what about the vaccination situation? Because that clearly is very important. I think that there are two major companies that are producing the vaccine for Mpox. Is there enough Mpox vaccine out there and is it accessible for people in Africa?
The vaccine so far is not accessible for the people in Africa, because the quantity is very small, and also because the regulatory processes in Africa did not allow initially to go very fast and apply the vaccine to the population. So we have some obstacle for the access of vaccine. There is some production that are going on. There is also some stockpile that are available. A lot of negotiation are being done to make sure that those vaccines will arrive where they are needed the most.
Would the WHO be encouraging pharmaceutical firms to get into production? As you say, there is not enough at the moment. You would presumably be encouraging greater production.
Absolutely. When we have a public health emergency of international concern, any entity that can contribute to the response are encouraged to do so. If the company that are producing a vaccine can do more, and WHO will also contact them and make sure that they are doing more of what they can do. But also sustainability is important for the pharmaceutical industry. And I do believe that we need also to work with any other entity that can help to make sure that this thing at least will be a sustainable business for them.
Dr. Abdou Salam Gaye there, speaking to me from Brazzaville. So there are two challenges, possible restrictions in the future and vaccine availability. Well, Elaine Fletcher is editor-in-chief at Health Policy Watch. I asked her what restrictions and policies may need to be implemented in the future.
We're still at the beginning of this crisis where it's simmering and expanding in Africa among populations that are malnourished, that are not getting adequate treatment for HIV. Their immune systems are compromised. Also, they're in DRC. They're in the midst of civil war, displacement, M23 rebel attacks. They're working in artisanal mines in the middle of rainforests, child labor, you know, the worst possible combination of circumstances. I'd call it like a perfect storm. So I think what really needs to happen here is attention to that perfect storm and nipping this in the bud. What really needs to happen is dealing with this in the Central and African countries where this is occurring.
So there might need to be sort of restrictions on travel in terms of potential transmission within that area where it is at the moment, crossing borders within Africa, for example.
I don't think you're going to be able to control travel. People migrate, that the borders are very porous. I can tell you that from having immediate colleagues working in that area. I have seen Nigeria just a couple of days ago put on, you know, you may see countries wanting proof of some sort of health form before you enter a country. But I think the big issue here is not travel.
But there is, the term now is being used, global health emergency. So there is clearly an expectation potentially of spread outside potentially Africa, I suppose, and certainly to other parts of Africa.
Yep. They call it a global health emergency because of the potential for it to spread much more widely and for as it spreads for new variants to emerge. This is a really good example of what Tedros at WHO has always said, you know, nobody's safe until everyone's safe type of thing.
What is the way to tackle that? Would it involve some kind of screening, perhaps, at certain points?
As we saw with the COVID virus, and frankly, I wasn't one of the people that was so opposed to travel restrictions just on a personal level, but it only slows things down by a few weeks. It doesn't stop it. The very, very big issue is rolling out a system in a place that's one of the most vaccine hesitant countries in Africa, DRC. I think what you need is an agreement with heads of state to start ramping out unrolling vaccines and treatment and surveillance, better watchdogging of this. And you need to get the price of the vaccine down so that African countries, or at least the WHO and Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, can afford to procure this in large enough quantities to really squash the current crisis.
Elaine Fletcher there of Health Policy Watch. So, vaccines, do we have enough of them? And can we get more? Bavaria Nordic is the main pharmaceutical company producing Mpox vaccine at the moment. I asked Dr. Sania Nishtar, CEO of Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, what supplies there were.
We have direct visibility on 65,000 doses, 50,000 from a stockpile that exists in the US and 50,000 from the Bavaria Nordic. We stand to understand that there is a significant stockpile in Japan and we are in parleys with them.
Okay, now Bavaria Nordic is one of the companies that has produced a particular vaccine for this. Are other companies getting into this as well? And one thinks, I suppose, of AstraZeneca, for example, from the COVID period. Are they also moving into this?
We have visibility of two manufacturers only, Bavaria Nordic and a Japanese manufacturer, and they're the ones we are speaking to at the moment.
Will that provide enough, though? Because you said there are 50,000, 65,000 doses. It's global health emergency suggests we'll need a lot more.
You're absolutely right. Currently, a mapping is also ongoing. We are trying to explore which stockpiles sit where in donor countries, because the interim and short-term measure is to mobilize those donations from those donor countries. We have to be mindful that manufacturing will take some time. It will take months.
Do you envisage other companies coming on board, other pharmaceutical companies coming on board with this as well?
We hope so, but as of now, we do not have any visibility and we don't expect that they will.
And there's an issue of cost, because at the moment, most of the cases are in Africa, and the ability to afford these doses will be a crucial issue, won't it?
Yes. You see, the furthest along in manufacturing are these two companies. We are negotiating on the cost, and the financing mechanism for these is the first response facility, as I just mentioned. We've structured that fund, the governance is in place, the mechanism of invoking and the eligibility criteria have all been internally decided and are approved by our boards, and the money exists as well. So on the funding side, for now, we're okay. Negotiations with the manufacturers are ongoing.
Now, in the past, as you know, of course, in India, there's a great capacity for the production of vaccines that exists. Would that be able to be brought on board in the same way it was for COVID?
Well, currently, these are the two manufacturers that are further along. Tech transfer takes a long time. So we don't think that the existing manufacturing capacity that came into play for COVID can be pivoted so soon. So this really is not happening over the short term.
That's rather worrying, isn't it? Given, as we know now, this is a global health emergency.
We are looking in it for the long term. There's a long-term strategy in place, which is predicated on the establishment of a vaccine stockpile for the mpox vaccine. And for that, of course, we have to look at capacity elsewhere, and tech transfer comes into play, and other manufacturing facilities that can bolster production capacity will also come into play there. But for the short term, we're looking at these two manufacturers. We're looking at those donations. We hope we'll be able to mobilize donations from donor countries. We expect that stockpiles would be sitting with some countries. And given that we need to act urgently, the short-term response is crucially important.
Dr. Sania Nishtar there of Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance.
Hello, I'm Simon Jack, the BBC's business editor.
And I'm Zing Sing, and I'm a journalist, author, and podcaster.
And it's great news. Good Bad Billionaire is back for a new season, now from the BBC World Service. So if you listened to our last series, welcome back. But if you're new to Good Bad Billionaire, why should people listen, Zing?
We are your new favourite podcast, exploring the minds, the motives, and the big money behind some of the world's richest people.
Some of these billionaire stories really are packed full of incident, intrigue, villainy in some cases.
Drama, family succession.
Yeah, if you like biopics, then this series is for you.
Good Bad Billionaire from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're listening to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, Japan's economy has been stuck in a pattern of stagnation for decades, and some are saying the latest growth figures are a sign that is coming to an end. Japan's economy expanded at an annualised 3.1% in the April to June quarter, marking the first growth in two quarters. And that was above expectations. Private consumption was up for the first time in five quarters too. And all this as inflation led the Bank of Japan to raise interest rates, which in turn caused some turmoil, you may remember, on the international markets. The Prime Minister, Fumio Kishida, has also said he will stand down amid pressure from voters who are angry at rising prices. So what does all this mean? I asked Takahide Kiyuchi, who's executive economist at the Nomura Research Institute in Tokyo.
Number is larger than previously expected in the financial market. But I think that in the first quarter, it dipped significantly. In average, I think that the first half of the GDP in Japan is not so strong. I think that the low growth rate is still continuing. We still have a big concern for the recovery of the consumption.
You don't think it's as impressive as all that. But in fact, the numbers are pretty good. I mean, annualized 3.1%, that's way above expectations. And in terms of consumption, it's the first rise in private consumption in more than a year. I mean, things are going somewhere.
Yeah, but if you see that the year-on-year growth rate, it's still negative, partly due to that reduction of the automobile productions. So I think that that's some sign of consumption because of that, the recovery of that wage growth rate. But I think that it's not enough to cause a clear recovery of the consumption because that the consumers are still concerned about that future increase of prices. I think that correction of the excess weaker yen could be a catalyst of that real recovery of the consumption in the future.
So you think the yen weakness is possibly the most important driving factor?
Because the higher inflation rate in Japan is mainly caused by the increase of import price.
Now, what about the Bank of Japan and interest rates? Because the rise in interest rates, which surprised some people, was quite unpopular in Japan as well. Maybe seeing what seems to be this rise in the size of the economy, do you expect more interest rate rises in the near future?
If the unstable financial market conditions continue, BOJ have to postpone that the timing of additional increase of interest rate. Now I expect that the BOJ may not increase interest rate again by the end of this year. And January of the next year could be a possible timing that BOJ may increase interest rate.
Now, finally, Mr. Kiyuchi, I mean, as long as I've been reporting on Japanese economy, I think it's been stuck in this, what many people see as a stagnation, not really being able to get out of its trap of low growth. Do you think the figures we're seeing now suggest a change in that, along with, of course, inflation and the movements by the BOJ? Do you think Japan is moving out of that historical moment?
Yeah, if you see that the high inflation rate and high wage growth rate and the sharp increase of equity price and weaker yen, maybe you may think it's a kind of sign of the change of the Japanese economy and the end of that deflation, which has lasted maybe 3 decades. But I think it's not correct. If you see that real time of the economy, for example, real GDP, it's still stagnating. And in the total of this calendar year, real GDP could be almost 0%. So there's no significant improvement of the Japanese economy. But if that weaker yen is corrected, that could be a boost for the Japanese economy. That could lead to the recovery of the consumption.
That was Takahide Kiyuchi of the Nomura Research Institute. Now let's speak to Emma Wall, Head of Investment Analysis and Research at Hargreaves Lansdown, who's joining us here on World Business Report. Emma, welcome.
Hello.
We were talking about the Japanese economy there, which, I mean, what do you read into that? Do you think that these figures suggest Japan is emerging perhaps from that stagnation?
I think one set of data is very difficult to call. I do disagree with the previous guest, however. I do think this does give the Bank of Japan more collateral with which to make a decision to raise rates, because really they've got an issue here with being so out of step with the rest of the developed world. Now, unless you're looking in the UK and Europe and the US and bank rates are coming down, but they've got to come down extremely far in order to be on a level with Japan. And it is hurting the currency. It is hurting the investability of the stock market. Mm. You know, we've seen extreme stock market volatility in Japan this year. So really, I think as a laser focus on what data points can come out of the economy, inflation, growth, jobs figures, that can give the Bank of Japan that collateral to raise rates.
All right. Thanks very much indeed, Emma. Emma Wall there, Head of Investment Analysis and Research at Hargreaves Lansdown. Now, Real Madrid's season got underway last night with a 2-0 victory over Atalanta in the UEFA Super Cup, with a player of the match performance from Jude Bellingham. Now, after winning both La Liga and the Champions League last season, he's seen the likes of Adidas and Louis Vuitton line up to sponsor him. So how far can Jude Bellingham's fortune go? Matt Lyons has been taking a look for Business Daily.
Those were the scenes at the Green Duck Brewery here in Stourbridge near Birmingham as Jude Bellingham opened the scoring in England's first game at the Euros this summer. Now, that's just a short walk from where I'm stood now, opposite a giant mural to the footballer who was born and raised right here. In front of me, I can see Jude painted looking out in his England kit, surrounded by images from his career, from playing football as a boy to holding up a jersey with his number 22 on it. So what do people here make of how he's done?
Some of those, you look at players, you think their quality. That is worth thinking of, whether it's from around here or not. I have mates that know him and used to play like Xbox and that of him during COVID. Just weird thinking about it. But yeah, he always seems so polite. You know, it's always good to see Stourbridge get mentioned on the TV and things like that. So obviously very jealous I didn't make it myself. But, I think it's a great thing for us to have.
Jude played his first professional game at his boyhood club, and full disclosure, the team I support, Birmingham City, at the age of just 16. We all knew he could be something very special even at that age, and it's gone very well since then.
Honestly, I don't think it could have gone any better.
Mina Riziki, European football journalist.
What it really is authenticity. And I think that's what makes Bellingham so special. He arrives, they ask him about, you know, all the British players that came before him, and he managed to list all of them. It's almost like he had come in and prepared.
Talk to me about Real Madrid. Just how beneficial has his signing been for them?
One of the things that they had noticed is that it always pays to have an English-speaking talent, even better if he's actually English. Because one of the things they want to target is a bigger audience in Africa. Africa is much more obsessed with the Premier League. And I think bringing in an English player, especially one that is considered to be, you know, a breakout star, the future of the English national team, that's helped increase eyeballs when it comes to Real Madrid playing.
And it's not just those in the football industry who are paying attention to Jude. Stuart Duguid is the agent of tennis superstar Naomi Osaka.
You really don't see that many other guys develop businesses like you've seen LeBron James develop a business in the US, for example. I would love to see Jude Bellingham be the next guy. I think he's the best footballer in the world, so ipso facto the best and biggest athlete in the world at the moment.
Let's take a look at who's on board the Jude train already. He's got a deal with Adidas.
Hello? Yeah, I'm all good, man. And you? I'm chilling at home, relaxing.
In fact, they've just launched his very own signature clothing collection with a JB logo based on Jude's own signature. They also paid the Beatles to use Hey Jude as part of their Euros campaign, so they're very much behind him. And before that tournament, Jude was seen modelling a pair of Skims, Kim Kardashian's underwear brand.
I'm Jude Bellingham. Everybody's wearing Skims.
And then there's the likes of Lucozade and McDonald's, who he's a face for too. So we have a recently turned 21-year-old hitting the peak of his career so far. People, brands and sponsors will all want a piece of him. So how do you manage that whilst focusing on your game? One man who knows is John Smith, former super agent turned sports investor who looked after the likes of Maradona.
What has to happen is it's all about the focus of what happens on the pitch, because it very quickly unravels. It's not for me to say, it's, you know, the people around him know what they're doing. But from an outsider looking in with a little bit of experience, I would say that he's done extremely well both on and off the pitch at the moment. I personally would draw breath now, play a lot of football. He's got a lot of time in front of him. You know, this is just the beginning of the journey.
John Smith there, ending that report by Matt Lyons on the future of Jude Bellingham. North Korea is to allow Western tourists to enter for the first time in nearly 5 years. North Korea sealed its borders at the start of the pandemic and only began to let its own citizens return last year. Before the borders shut, around 5,000 Western tourists used to visit the country each year, often with delicate advice from their guides.
It's a very important place, so watch your behaviour. I mean, when we go on the statue, that's in front of the statue, off your sunglasses, don't put your hand to the pocket.
A North Korean tour guide for Korea Tours instructed tourists how to behave in front of statues of former North Korean leaders. The country will reopen only one city to foreign tourists in December. That's according to two China-based operators, who announced they will soon be allowed to visit the mountainous northern city of Samgyeon. Well, Julia Dullard works at the Swedish tourist agency Korea Consult, which organises trips to North Korea, as well as China, Mongolia and Turkmenistan. She told me about Samgyeon.
This is a special area located on the border with China. Mount Paektu, it's a holy mountain for Koreans and even for Chinese. So this is a very beautiful place, a volcano with a lake inside. Magnificent views, but it is a remote area. You cannot get there by bus, by train. North Koreans can go by train, but not foreigners.
So how would foreigners go there then?
We had to charter a flight from Pyongyang to this area. It's not so easy to get there. But from China, it's possible. But you cannot cross the border from China to North Korea in this mountain. It's not possible. That's why I'm not really sure how it will be organized.
So it's hard to see how this is going to work, though, even though they've given permission. It's hard to see how you can make it happen.
Well, yes, it's not clear yet because we didn't get all the information yet. We just got a message that tours will be allowed in this area, but we didn't get any practical information how we will get there. From China or from Pyongyang? This is not clear yet.
Obviously, during this period when tourists have been banned completely, I guess this has been rather bad for your business because you used to take quite a few people there.
Yes, of course. North Korea is a very special destination. It's not for mass tourism. Very few people travel there. Mostly Chinese, of course, but Westerners, well, it was maybe several thousands a year from all travel companies. Of course, it was not good for us not to be able to run tours for 4.5 years, definitely. So it was a hard time for all travel companies.
Indeed. But I mean, if I wanted now to go to North Korea, and as you say, the details aren't clear yet, how much would it cost me if I booked a trip through your agency?
The thing is that this announcement was made yesterday. We have to see what kind of prices they will give us. From Beijing to Pyongyang and sightseeing tour in North Korea for 1 week. Before the COVID, it was about 1,500, 600 euros per person, including flight, return flight from Beijing, accommodation and all meals and the guiding. You have to be all the time with two guides there. So actually, you don't have to spend so much money when you are there. It's all prepaid.
And what about restrictions when you get there? I mean, you said you have to be with guides all the time. Does it feel very much as if you can only see what they want you to see?
This is the rule. You have to accept a restriction. You have to accept it. If you cannot, then better not to go there. But guides are very nice. They do everything to feel us comfortable. Of course, we cannot go anywhere we want. But this is how it is in this country.
So, Julia, if I said to you, OK, I'm thinking about it, will I see some interesting, good things? Is it worth me going to North Korea, even under these conditions?
Absolutely. I can say that most of the people who travel to North Korea, they say it's one of the best trips of their lives. But most of the people know what kind of conditions they will meet there. They have to accept that. So those who don't accept special restrictions, they just don't travel there. This is not a destination for everyone. Absolutely not.
Julia Dallard there of the Swedish tourist agency Korea Consult, talking about trips that she may now be organising into North Korea for the first time in 5 years. Now, I have to say, I have never got inside North Korea. I got very, very close. I was on the Russian side for our sister programme, in fact, Business Matters, coming down from Vladivostok right to the border, and I was able to gaze across the river into North Korea, and, well, I got arrested for my pains, but that's another story for another day. But that was the closest I got to North Korea. So that's it from World Business Report. We're back tomorrow at the same time. But for me, from now and the rest of the team, thanks for being with us and bye-bye.
Hello, I'm Simon Jack, the BBC's business editor.
And I'm Xing Xing, and I'm a journalist, author and podcaster.
And it's great news. Good Bad Billionaire is back for a new season, now from the BBC World Service. So if you listened to our last series, welcome back. But if you're new to Good Bad Billionaire, why should people listen, Xing?
We are your new favourite podcast, exploring the minds, the motives and the big money behind some of the world's richest people.
Some of these billionaire stories really are packed full of incident, intrigue, villainy in some cases.
Drama, family succession.
Yeah, if you like biopics, then this series is for you.
Good Bad Billionaire from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.